Okay, I'll give you the title right away. Let me give you the title in a minute. Abraham Lincoln once called a meeting. What I have forgotten is what the meeting was about. This is during his Civil War, and so he called a meeting of the cabinet. And he took a poll on an action that he had proposed. And he said, all in favor say aye, A-Y-E, that aye. And so Lincoln said aye. He was the single aye. And then he said, all opposed, nay. And everybody said, nay, no. And Lincoln looked at the rest of the cabinet and he said, well, gentlemen, it looks like the ayes have it. He proceeded with the decision that he had to make. So the ayes have it, seeing past self. You can use ayes like regular ayes, not the aye that he was using. We hardly ever use aye like that. Now, the Scots still do. If you go to Scotland, you'll ask them a question, and they won't always answer with yes. They'll say, oh, aye lad. And they'll answer. In fact, an awful lot of the English down in Yorkshire, that was actually a North Yorkshire accent that I stumbled across there, would do the same thing. We're going to look at the eyes, though, and focusing on actual eyes. All Christians, true Christians, should automatically desire to be positive and upbeat persons, but this world seems too much infected with negativism. When it comes to mastering a positive frame of mind in God's way of life and the plan of salvation that it really demands, our Creator gave us the eye with an E at the front of it, E-Y-E instead of A-Y-E, and that enables us to see past the negative pressures of life and past our own selfish interest and have that positive frame of mind that comes from being able to see past oneself, because self tends to want us to focus inward. Let's look first of all at the eyes of God. There are scriptures that talk about this. We'll start with 2 Chronicles 16. 2 Chronicles 16, the eyes of God. Here we are, or here we almost are. 2 Chronicles 16, the verse is verse 9. And we'll pick up the story, though, in verse 7. At that time, Hanani, the seer, that would be a prophet, came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you have relied upon the king of Syria, and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Assyria has escaped from your hand. Were the Ethiopians and the Lubim, that's another nation or tribe that was in that area, were the Ethiopians and the Lubim not a large army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. He reminded him of a victory that God had given Esau. But in verse 9 comes the ominous statement, for the eyes of the Eternal run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. Unfortunately for Asa, he had not been loyal to God because he had been disobeying God. So it goes on to say, but in this you have done foolishly. Therefore, from now on you shall have wars. Asa was very angry with the seer and put him in prison, for he was enraged at him because of this. And Asa oppressed some of the people at that time, probably those who particularly were supportive of Asa and who were faithful to God. But God's eyes run to and fro upon the whole earth to see, show himself strong on the behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. In essence, it's a way of describing, you know, running to and fro. God is omniscient. He knows what's happening everywhere all the time. He's not like us where he has to get his eyes locked on something to see it. God sees everything that's happening because he's God and we're only physical. But what else does he see? Let's look in Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs 15. What else does God see that often we don't? Chapter 15 of Proverbs in verse 3. The eyes of the Lord are in every place keeping watch on the evil and the good. So the language of his eyes go to and fro upon the whole earth. In essence, God sees everything, and that's what verse 3 says. He sees everything. You know, it's like Santa Claus. He knows if you've been bad or good. Remember the silly song? And it's a silly song, but it also points out that the idolatry of that particular holiday to describe the hero of the holiday of Christmas is Santa Claus. It isn't Jesus Christ. It's certainly not the true Jesus Christ of the Bible. But it manifests Santa Claus as having godlike powers. Santa Claus is an idol, nothing else. God has godlike powers. God does see everything. He hears everything. He sees everything. And then that should give us something to think about if God sees everything and hears everything too. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 4 as we continue the study on the eyes of God, seeing past self. Or the eyes have it, seeing past self. Thinking back to Abraham Lincoln there for a minute. Hebrews chapter 4. We would like to look in verses 12 and 13. Hebrews chapter 4. I want to pick up in verse 11 to give the full paragraph. Let us therefore be diligent to enter the rest, or that rest, lest anyone fall according to the example of disobedience. The rest that he was describing here is talking about ultimately God's kingdom and comparing it backwards to when the Israelites established their kingdom, in a sense, or their nation, in the Promised Land. So we look forward to a different and a greater promised land than what Joshua looked forward to in verse 8. So therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the example of disobedience. For the word of God is living and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. What God is saying through Paul, who we believe wrote Hebrews, is that God reads our minds and the intents of our hearts, what we think in the inner part of our mind. And then verse 3, and there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. God sees everything. He is aware of everything. He reads our minds, so he can see what we're thinking in that sense. So the guy, going back to our title, the eyes have it. The eyes really do have it. The eyes of God. He has a capability of seeing everything. Now let's look at eyes in a different way, you know, because we have to determine what kind of eyes we have spiritually, and so this is important. Let's go to Matthew chapter 6. And why the eyes here, we could also, you know, use a modern term which is tied to concept of eyes, outlook. You know, what is your outlook? When you think of an outlook and you take the word apart, it's where you can look out across something. Or out of window, what's your outlook of from your window? So it's, again, it's using the eyes, the sense of either physical vision or mental vision, conceptual vision as well. Matthew 6 and verse 22 and 23. Now this is in the parable of, or not the parable, but in the Sermon on the Mount. We look in, make sure, well, it's number 5. I better have chapter 6. Here we are. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. And when somebody asks you, well, what's your outlook on this? This is a concept of outlook. The lamp of the body is the eye. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore that light that is in you is darkness, then how great that darkness is. If you have the wrong outlook, if you're not looking to God, then you're looking at darkness. You don't have the spiritual insight that comes from following God and his way of life. The world is in that kind of darkness now. We were, before we knew God's truth, But God has given us a perspective of an ability to see what's actually happening in the world, to be aware of, from a prophetic standpoint, of what God is going to be doing in the world, all those kinds of things. And that's a part of our outlook or our eyes. The eyes have it. Seeing past self. If all you can see is self and sell your own selfish interests, then you're looking at darkness. Now, to think about selfish interest, just think about the news over the past week or the past 2 weeks or 2 months. It doesn't matter. It really hasn't changed. It's only gotten worse as far as any substantial change. It's just gradually getting worse. Sometimes it makes little leapfrog jumps of worseness in that sense. But the world is getting more and more in a state of moral and spiritual darkness. More and more. Increasingly, they are legislating falsehood, morality falsehood, sexual perversion, and they're legislating that. And anybody who disagrees is increasingly being put into the position of being essentially an outlaw. Now, that's a turn left that we've only recently entered. You know, up to now, you had sexual immorality in society as God defines it, and God is the only one who defines it. You've had sexual immorality, and it has become more militant over the years. But it has never been able to leverage the governments of various nations, including the United States. It has never been able to leverage the governments to enforce that perversion almost onto the society, making everybody else who believes in the traditional morality that is frankly common sense as well as divinely revealed, making them outlaws. So we took a hard left turn, as if we weren't going left in the sense of liberal before. This was a sharp left turn. And that has only been in the past year, and maybe more closely the past 6 months. And some of it has been, a lot of that steering has been happening just in the past couple of months. The intensity of the perversity of society is increasing really, really dramatically. Bad eyes. Eyes full of darkness. We don't want to have eyes full of darkness. I think in that contrast, we can right away begin to see it. So let's consider then what a good eye looks like. You know, where you have eyes that are full of light and spiritual understanding, love for and obedience to God. Eyes full of positive, true positive thinking. Positive thinking as positive is defined by God, not just by us. I mean, Jesse James would have positive thinking if he thought he could knock over that bank and you know, kill a few bank guards in the process. Now, that would be success for Jesse back in the day. It would not be a success for the people whose money he stole or the lives that he took. And believe me, he took plenty of lives and he stole a lot of money over the course of his career. And probably our most famous outlaw in American history. But whatever the case, it serves as an example here. Nothing against Jesse or his clan in that sense directly. Proverbs chapter 22. Proverbs 22. What a good eye looks like. In verse 9, he who has a generous eye will be blessed, for he gives his bread to the poor. Now, the generous eye and giving, you know, helping those who are in need, we stop and think, how's he using the eye there? Well, the generous eye is one who is looking out for others, is watching. Those who have eyes to see is another phrase out of the Bible. So here's somebody who's watching and realize, well, some of the people need to eat this bread. I shouldn't just throw it all to the ducks in the park. Let me put it where it can do better use. The ducks can eat other stuff. You know, they can fend for themselves. And actually, it's better for them if they do. But a generous eye will be blessed. God is happy with someone who looks out for others, those in need, and does what they can Now, they can't do everything, but they do what they can for the others. So that's a generous eye. That's a good quality of character. It describes the nature of a generous eye. It's sharing, it's outgoing, it's concern for others. And that kind of generosity, though, has another ingredient. It's focused on God, isn't it? But what does an evil eye look like? You know, back even in the Bible, the term evil eye is often used, and some of it is right here in Proverbs. We'll come back to that in a minute. You might want to just leave your fingers in Proverbs. But turn first to Deuteronomy chapter 15. Deuteronomy chapter 15. We'll start in, verse 9, I think. Let me look at the page here. No, actually, we'll start in verse 7. If there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of the gates of your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand to your poor brother. You know, in other words, you need to have a generous eye toward the poor brother. But you should open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be any wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year of release is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing. And then he cries out to the Lord, and it becomes sin among you. Because of that. Now, the year of release, that's in the previous verses, start where the chapter starts and goes down through. At the end of every 7 years, let's go back and define that term. At the end of every 7 years, verse 1, chapter 15, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor to whom who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. You may require it of a foreigner, but not of a fellow Israelite, essentially. And it goes on to describe that. Ultimately, the plan is, except when there be, in verse 4, no poor among you. So if the debt is not a hardship to the individual, eventually, then it can be collected. But when it's the poor who are borrowing, every seventh year, those debts were released. Now, that coincided, of course, with the land Sabbath year, because Israel, in ancient times, was fundamentally agricultural. All nations were. And God established a way for the soil's fertility to be guarded, and that was by not cropping it every seventh year. You just let it lie fallow, let it rest up. All the microorganisms help rebuild soil fertility. Don't prune your trees. You know, let them grow a little bit wild, and you can prune them, you know, when you start the new cycle and go into year number one after that, but not in year seven. And you can eat fruit as it comes in season. You can eat vegetables that come up volunteer. As they come in season, you can't store any. You don't harvest it to store it. That's how the land Sabbath works. And in conjunction with that was the year of release, so that the debts that we might call them consumer debts, I don't know that would be an exact comparison, but these were where there were poor who needed to borrow just to make ends meet. And then they had to pay it back, of course. But if it wasn't all paid back by the seventh year, it was canceled. And you think, well, what kind of a law is that? What kind of a law is chapter 11 bankruptcy? What do you think that was copied from? It's this principle is the law of the chapter 11 bankruptcy. It's this principle. And so, in a sense, our bankruptcy laws, although they weren't perfectly following what God laid out, this would be better. Because then you don't have this massive consumer debt building up. But you don't have people lending foolishly either. If it's going to be canceled in 7 years, you lend where lending is needed and not where it's not. In our society, driven by selfishness, the evil selfish eye has built a whole system that's completely wrong. In the millennial age, this is the way it will be. Until there aren't any poor among you, which is the beauty of God's system. So we have then, that's the background, the year of release. And so somebody says, hold it, you need how much? let me see, the year of release, that's only 2 years away. No, you could never pay me back in 2 years. I'm not going to borrow. I'm not going to lend you that. Forget it. Go talk to somebody else. God says, don't do that, because you've got an evil eye if you're selfish like that, when you have the ability to make the loan. So the evil eye is a selfish eye, a self-focused eye in that sense. Always looking out only for your things and your situation, and not caring a whit for other people's genuine needs. Let's go to Judges, just a few books over. Judges chapter 21, and look at another example of the wrong use of the eyes. Judges 21. Happens to be the last chapter of Judges, and it's the last verse. In those days, verse 25, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The culture was selfishly focused. It didn't care about others. There was no structure, no order that was established societally. And then the king eventually, looking back, a king imposed a certain order on society, and the good kings made sure that those laws were obeyed. Bad kings, of course, didn't. And it was like not having a king at all in some of their cases, except you had a tyrant who was supposed to be the king. No king was in Israel. Everybody did what was right in his own eyes. And that kind of behavior is that they didn't focus their eyes on God, they so focused on self and self-gratification. So what kind of a society do we have now? We have a society that is focused on self-gratification. It's focused on selfish interests only. Let's go back now to the Proverbs, chapter 23. We'll start in verse 1, but verse 6 is our target. Proverbs 23, and beginning in verse 1, when you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is set before you. See, this is not necessarily a good ruler. But put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. You know, some kings offer gifts if you will turn traitor to your friends or to those who he perceives are his enemies. So there are all kinds of negotiating ways. This is bad leadership. When you have leadership that does that kind of thing, and they court the favor of people who can do them favors. And normally the do them favors means to eradicate their political opposition. Put a knife to your throat if you're a man given to appetite. Don't go to this kind of a banquet hungry. You know, stop at one of the, even have to stop at a fast food place before you get there. Do it, you know, so that you aren't hungry. Do not desire his delicacies, they are deceptive food. Do not overwork to be rich. Follows along. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings and fly away like an eagle to evil toward heaven. So we have the miser the ruler there, the evil ruler, and you could end up being an evil ruler in a sense yourself of becoming rich. You know, you set your eyes on that which is not. That ruler was setting his eyes on political expediency and eradicating anybody that was opposed to him. Well, that's the same as just trying to get, all you do is try to increase your wealth or your power. Wealth and power go together. A fool and his money are soon parted is another way of saying verse 5. And then we come to verse 6. Do not eat the bread of a miser, nor desire his delicacies. For as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. And the morsel you have eaten, you will vomit up and waste your pleasant words. So this is another version of the first three verses. The word miser. Do not eat the bread of one with an evil eye. Now, only in modern times have we stopped using the term evil eye. because it wasn't but a couple of hundred years ago the term evil eye, so-and-so has an evil eye. They use that to describe people. It was the way they looked at things. And there's a certain glint and a focus. You know, if you stand around quietly in a crowd, just stand and quietly watch where people are looking. Especially if you sort of know some of them, and even if you don't, just what are they looking at? And just try to construct what's their focus? Why are they looking at that thing or looking at that person over there? There are reasons why. In many cases, some people just stand around gawking and they don't know what they're looking at. But don't you know that's they're going to be false leads. But you're looking at those who focus on something and you try to guess what it is they're focused on. But we don't want to be focused on one who has an evil eye. We don't want to have an evil eye like the miser. The miser who is only concerned with his wealth or with his power, he's not concerned about you or anybody else. So don't have an evil eye like that. The evil eye is selfish, ungenerous, and self-focused as well. Now in chapter 28, we're just a few pages over, a lot of wisdom in the Proverbs on this particular topic. Chapter 28 of Proverbs, and we want to look at verse 22. This is a reinforcing statement in verse 22. A man with an evil eye hastens after riches and does not consider the poverty that poverty will come upon him. Those with the evil eye just chase after riches, whether they're outlaws, politicians, just selfish businessmen or just selfish people. I mean, who are fundamentally self-focused. And we have a society where a huge percentage of our population in almost every nation is that way now. This world cannot function long in the condition that it's in. So much self-focus, so much of the evil eye, always looking out for self, not concerned with others at all. And there are other kind of aspects of the evil eye. It isn't just wealth. Let's go to Isaiah. The prophet Isaiah, we want to be right near the beginning in chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3, and we'll look in verse 16. Let me give you the context, though. It starts in verse 13. It's describing oppression and luxury. I mean, not regular luxury, but exorbitant luxury. The Lord stands up in verse 13 to plead. He stands up to plead and to judge the people. The Eternal will enter into judgment with the elders of his people and his princes, for you have eaten up the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor, says the Lord God, the Eternal of Hosts. Let me back up on this as an example. We have here, you've eaten up the vineyard and you plunder the poor. Eating up the vineyard is an agricultural term. In other words, you've taken all the grapes for yourself. We have in our age, counterpoint to that, massive corporations who have gotten so big that in most cases they don't really have a moral thought in their heads. Their only focus is to get bigger, to gobble up other corporations, get more wealth and more power. Long ago, the idealism of the starters of those companies has gone, if they had some. Some of them didn't really have any either, and that's why they are like they are today. But some had some. They had a moral conscience for what they were doing. But take the example of agriculture. We have what is now called Big Farm, massive agribusiness corporations who really don't care about the health of the soil. They don't care. They think the soil is a machine, and you dump chemicals in it, and it gives you money. They have no thought in the fact that the crops they're producing have less and less food value and far more residual poisons drawn from the chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers that they're dumping into the soil, plus they're killing the soil. They had no concept. They're bad farmers, very bad farmers. They don't have any idea that soil is almost a living thing in itself. Only about 5 or 6 inches of it. That's where the microorganisms are, the topsoil, the top of the topsoil, in fact. That's where the living part of the soil is that is so vital to all aspects of, you know, a healthy environment for human beings and rest of the animals too, for that matter. To them, soil is a machine, and you treat it just like a machine, and so they ruin the soil. Now that, and yeah, I'm saying that as a general statement there, but scientific research on sustainable agriculture has begun to verify it scientifically, that that's the case. And thus some of the great and monstrous big farm organizations, especially the ones that produce the chemical fertilizers and such, they're starting to have lower income because there is a movement afoot that that's not sustainable. You can't treat the soil like that and expect it to provide for future generations. Sustainable agriculture is putting a dent in their armor, a bad dent, a dent that they should have anticipated, but of course they haven't. You know why? Their eyes were focused on self, the self of the corporation, if nothing else. They weren't looking outward for the health of the nation, even the nation, let alone the other nations. And they affect a lot of other nations too. They're focused on self, and consequently, we're reaping a bitter harvest and will be worse as time goes by. There are all kinds of ramifications of that. So let's go on down, but there are other kinds of selfish thinking too, even more perverse in certain ways. Verse 16, moreover, the Eternal says, because the daughters of Zion are haughty with outstretched necks and wanton eyes. is what is described here. That means seductive, ogling eyes. It's the adulterous look. It isn't just the men, it's the women. And in many nations, the women have been, you know, the moral pillars from that perspective of being against adultery in its various forms, but that is disappearing rapidly. I mean, very rapidly in the past handful of years. What is the condition of a society when the women have wanton eyes? It's not a good thing. Basically, it's just selfish and self-seeking, self-gratification. It's everything self, nothing toward God, nothing even out toward others. The evil eye is symbolic of a phrase that refers to the sinful, envious, and selfish person. That's Nelson's Illustrated Bible Dictionary talks about that. I would like to go to Matthew chapter 7 now, and we look at the way Christ himself uses the term and describes it. Matthew 7. This is a great story. Judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with what measure you use, it will be measured to you. We have a saying in English that what goes around comes around. If that's what you go around doing, it's going to come around and do to you. It's the same way. And why, then we get to this, and why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but you do not consider the plank that is in your eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll be able to see to remove the speck from your brother's eye. You know, we read that, yeah, there's a speck and it's back in his eye, and so you're going to get, but you can't see it because, or can't get at it because you got this plank, so you can't get close enough to reach the speck in his eye to take it out. So you just, you know, accuse him of having a speck in his eye when you've got a power line pole sticking out of your eye. It's exaggeration for effect. Jesus Christ was not only a sober-minded person, he was a very, very funny man. He knew humor. He invented humor. This is humorous. It's also true. in jest is truth, is one of the great sayings of Shakespeare, because it actually is a truism. But the plank in your eye, you can see a speck, but we read this with the Bible monotone. Oh yeah, I've got a plank in my eye, I've got to get the plank before I can get the speck. And we lose the dramatic impact until you replace plank with something bigger that suddenly, I see the point now, that's funny. Christ used, this is called the humorous technique, is hyperbole. It's exaggeration for effect. Nobody can stick a plank in their eye. So it isn't an actual plank that we're talking about, but it's the effect of having an actual plank, I suppose. Years ago, we had an artist in the church back in the early years in the 20th century, and that was Basil Wolverton. And he illustrated this particular statement of Christ very well. I think it was in the Spokesman's Club manual, the men's speech manual. But you had this guy with his huge, he was a telephone pole in his case, sticking out of his eye. You know, major plank if it's a telephone pole. But it's the eye. You have one guy had an evil eye because he only looked at himself and focused on what he could get for himself. But he sure did pick out the tiny specks in other people's eyes. So it's a matter of looking out for others. You all seek self. Break the commandments of God. You shall love the Lord your God with all your being. And love your neighbor as yourself. Selfishness does not do that. It does not make us upbeat. It doesn't make us positive. It doesn't make us happy. Look in Mark chapter 8 now. Let's go to Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, we want to begin in verse 15. All right, here we are. He charged them, saying, "Take heed and beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." The leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. The background on this, Christ left them in verse 13, and getting into the boat again, they departed to the other side. Now, when the disciples had forgotten to take bread, they did not have more than one loaf with them in the boat. Somebody forgot to go to the bakery before they left that side of the Sea of Galilee. And when Christ found out about it, then he makes this statement, which just seemed a little obtuse at the time, I'm sure, because the apostles or the apostles to be were not what you would call quick wits. I think they learned to be. Christ was training them. He was the quick wit. He said, "Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And so what did they do? Well, they reasoned among themselves over 16. Is it because we forgot the bread? And we brought no bread. And Christ became aware of that. He says, "Why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not perceive nor understand? How is it that your heart is hardened? Having eyes, you do not see, and having ears, you don't hear. Don't you remember? When I broke five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you pick up?" And they said, "Well, 12. And when I broke seven loaves for 4,000 people, how many large baskets of fragments did you take up?" Well, they said, "Seven." And he said, "How is it that you don't understand?" You know, they were just slow on the uptake. We can be that way sometimes. But when we study God's way and we apply our minds to it, we get a little quicker witted, quicker minded, quicker thinking. We have eyes to see. That's the key. They didn't have eyes to see. They couldn't say, "Oh, he's pulling a lesson out of this." They thought, "Oh, no, we forgot bread and Herod and the Pharisees and we forgot the bread." That's not the point, that you forgot the bread. We don't need to worry about that. If we need more bread, he said, "I can make bread, remember?" No, don't. I want you to be aware of the teaching of the Pharisees and the political purposes of Herod. Beware of those things. That's what he was getting at. They didn't have eyes to see the point. So the question is, how quickly do we get the point? How swiftly can we pick up on what God is teaching us through His Word and through our experiences in life? Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. Another indictment on our society today. 2 Peter chapter 2. We have Peter describing the depravity of society. Now, there were elements of society then that were depraved. How they would compare to ours, you know, possibly very similar, but probably not as bad as what we are seeing our society descend into now. And we know this is going to happen. It's not a surprise. And we are not surprised because of that. We know that the prophecies indicate that the moral culture of the world will descend deeper and deeper into sin just prior to the second coming of Christ. And we thought it was bad in the past. And it was. And it's gotten worse all along. But it has begun to make quantum progress downward, not upward, not in a good way, but downward. Okay, so in verse 12, we pick it up. But these, like natural brute beasts made to be caught and destroyed, speak evil of the things they do not understand and will utterly perish in their own corruption. They speak evil of things they do not understand and will perish in their own corruption. What is one of the main descriptions of modern politics? Corruption, in the way that we use that term. But add in the corruption in comparison to God's law. In verse 13, and they will receive the wages of unrighteousness as those who count it pleasure to carouse in the daytime. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions while they feast with you. You see, that had the depravity of the Roman Empire had made its inroads by the time of 2 Peter. This would be in the 60s A.D. The church had only existed 30, 35 years by this time. Shortly after he wrote 2 Peter, Peter was imprisoned, and then he was beheaded, not beheaded, he was crucified upside down in prison about 68, 67 or 68 A.D. The church began in 31, 35 years in, give or take. And this inroads of moral degeneracy had gotten into God's church. And it's getting into the church now as well. Periodically, it's gotten better, the church has, and then just as certainly as it gets better, the guard is dropped and it starts to go backwards into the depravity of the world. So we go on. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. Eyes full of adultery. Now that has never been more obvious than in modern times with the advent of the internet. Pornography addiction is one of the greatest plagues in our time. And it was, although my statistic is a year and a half or 2 years old, the last report from one of our ministers who monitors these things is that the fastest growing segment of society that was becoming addicted to pornography were 11-year-old girls. Not just the boys, but the girls. It's not a good thing. See, it's making its inroads because it's so readily available, and children are not being taught how to use the internet. Parents are sometimes themselves caught up in that kind of an addiction. That's a description of our society, though. Eyes full of adultery. They don't seem to know anyway. The ideal of a man and a wife married and raising children is disappearing. That was the ideal. Anything outside of that was perversion, obviously, in the past, and now the perversion is the ideal has become the perversion, or virtually become the perversion in society today, here in the 2000 teens. Let's go over to 1 John chapter 2, just a page or two. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes. Eyes full of adultery, it's the lust of the eyes in that case. It can be, the lust of the eyes can be applied to other kinds of lusts. Lust is not a good word, it's a bad thing, it's a sin, it's always a sin. The lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. That's not God's way, that's the world's way. So don't try to reason in some twisted way that that which is evil is actually what God teaches. That's not a healthy thing to do. The world is passing away, and the lust of it, including the lust of the eyes, the bad eyes, the evil eyes, but he who does the will of God abides forever. And finally, let's go back as we draw this to a close to Galatians 5, and then we'll have to visit Timothy briefly. Galatians chapter 5. This is the works of the flesh, which are listed right alongside the fruits of God's Holy Spirit. We're going to look in verses 19 to 20-21. In being a successfully positive, energetic, upbeat, true Christian, where does self come in? So that's the question. Where does self come in? Verse 19, the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, lust of the eyes, fornication, dittos, uncleanness, lewdness, lust of the eyes are involved there, idolatry. They look at the idols that they worship, and that's part of how they pay homage to their idols. Sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousy, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelry. Drunkenness goes along with drug addiction or drug usage, because that's the purpose of the drug. It's much quicker. Drunkenness is what it is. That's the whole idea. You know, it's not because you want to have brilliant insight. You know, some fools think that, the poor people, poor deluded people, but it isn't the case at all. It's a type of drunkenness. Revelries and the like, of which I said beforehand, just as I've told you in time past, those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. This is not what we seek. We follow the fruits of the Spirit, which follow along in the next paragraph. But these are the fruits of the flesh. How many of these behaviors and mindsets produce positive, outgoing, godly attitude, a positive outlook? None of them do. They all focus on self and getting for self. Mr. Herbert Armstrong, many years ago, was being interviewed on television Ceylon. As when it was Sri Lanka now. They've gone back and forth, what they want to call the country, Sri Lanka or Ceylon. At that time, it was television Ceylon. And the reporter asked him a question. You know, they were kind of impressed with a very elderly man, old man in the white hair, and a wise man. And Orientals, you know, have a penchant for paying respect to people like that, much more than many other cultures did at the time. And so he asked Mr. Armstrong, what do you think is the world's greatest problem? The greatest problem of the world. And I remember we all saw the video, many of us did it anyway. He responded instantly, Mr. Armstrong did, he said, self. Self is the world's greatest problem. People think about self and getting for self without guard for giving and serving others, and especially not serving and loving God. This is the world's greatest problem. If we could overcome self, we could overcome all the rest of our problems. If you could overcome self, because then you can focus on God. And then God will show us how to solve everything else. Self and selfish interests. The evil eye is based on self and selfishness. That's the eye that you don't want to have. The eye you do want to have is outgoing, looking toward God. 2 Timothy chapter, this is our last passage, chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. I have a brand new Bible, and you know, most Bibles, after I use them for a while, you can grab it and you kind of open it. Ah, I came within a book, you know. New one, you have to fumble around a little bit, but I have it now. Verse 1. This talks about our time. Know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. Perilous means dangerous times. For men will be lovers of others and really caring and concerned about them. Oh, no, not at all. They will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents. They will be unthankful and unholy and unloving and unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despised.